Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fourth Age podcast's first episode of our Towers of Midnight read-through commentary. I, of course, am Andrew Gellos, and with me today is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. It's great to be here as always, and I'm really looking forward to yet another read-through of Towers of Midnight, because it's pretty much been non-stop Towers of Midnight with me lately. So I'm pretty much ready for this.
Well, but before we get into the actual discussion for this particular episode, we would like to state in all seriousness and honesty that we're going to be spoiling everything in Towers of Midnight and everything from the previous portions of the series and possibly things from other science fiction series. Possibly not, considering it's a recap, but, you know, best to be safe. If you haven't read all the way through the Wheel of Time books, and you especially haven't read Towers of Midnight, tune out of this episode until you do, because we don't want to be responsible for you being upset with us.
That's true. Absolutely not. I have occasionally been known to spoil stuff inadvertently, and I'm going to try very hard not to spoil anything outside of the Wheel of Time, but everything inside the Wheel of Time world is fair game, including the Big White Book and anything else we can think of. Interviews, you name it. If we can find it, we're going to talk about it.
So, this particular episode is going to focus on the prologue of Towers of Midnight. The title of the prologue is Distinctions, and it begins with a rather lengthy header this time, which we've decided that we're just going to go ahead and read straight out, because it's a really nice piece and gives us at least something to look forward to at the end of Memory of Light. From The Dragon Reborn, written by Loyal, son of Arendt, son of Halon, of Steading Shangti.
It soon became obvious, even within the Steading, that the pattern was growing frail. The sky darkened. Our dead appeared, standing in rings outside the borders of the Steading, looking in. Most troublingly, trees fell ill, and no song would heal them. It was in this time of sorrows that I stepped up to the great stump. At first, I was forbidden, but my mother, Corvril, demanded I have my chance. I do not know what sparked her change of heart, as she herself had argued quite decisively for the opposing side. My hands shook. I would be the last speaker, and most seemed to have already made up their minds to open the Book of Translation. They considered me an afterthought, and I knew that unless I spoke true, humanity would be left alone to face the shadow. In that moment, my nervousness fled. I felt only a stillness, a calm sense of purpose. I opened my mouth, and I began to speak.
Cool.
I will go ahead and apologize. Normally, I get a little more rumble into Loyal, but, you know, different days and different vocal responses, so if people are awesome with, you know, my performance, great. And if not, well, you know, I'll probably do better at some other point in time.
There you go. Well, that was pretty good. I was happy.
Ogier are always ridiculously difficult to do.
Oh, yeah. I know. I think we could probably talk a little bit about that section.
But no, you're right. I think we can talk a little bit about this, because
the Book of Translation.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, the thing about the header, really, is that this is Loyal's only appearance in the book. And it gives us a glimpse of what's happening around and about the setting. Partially, I think, because there might not be a great amount of time in A Memory of Light to devote toward the backstory of what was happening with the Ogier during all this time. I mean, I imagine we're going to get at least a piece or a flashback to Loyal talking at the Great Stump. But I'm going to guess that, by and large, any amount of Ogier that we end up seeing in the last battle, or in the last book, is probably going to be last battle oriented.
I'm actually looking forward to seeing the Randland Ogier, if you will, exhibiting some of the traits that the Shanshan Ogier gardeners do. I would just love to see battalions of Ogier, you know, in full battle mode. They're such impressive beings, and we mainly see the loyal type, you know, the gentle, kind, book-loving, tree-hunting Ogier. And we saw a whole other side of the Ogier with the gardeners. And we saw a few glimpses of it with Loyal, too. I particularly loved the scene in, I believe it was Dragon Reborn, where Fahil runs into the room in the inn, and the little hedgehog carving has been planted there as a trap, and she falls into almost suspended animation and lost in the wolf dream. And Perrin decides to go in after her into the wolf dream, and he tells Loyal, I need to go rescue Fahil. Will you watch my back? And Loyal just gives him a hard look, and he says, "None shall pass while I live, not a Murdral or the Dark One himself." And it's like, wow, you know, you can totally believe that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then it happens again, even though, mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it obviously happens during the battle in the Stone of Tyr. They made, like, mention of, like, Loyal, like, fending off with, like, a group of, I want to say, women and children behind him. Mm-hmm. They truly do give him some really great moments that show that, yes, for being a pacifist at heart, when pushed, you know, the boulder's going to roll back on you.
Well, we saw him at Two Rivers, you know, fighting the Trollocs and side by side with the Aiel. And then we actually saw a glimpse of Elder Haman also taking up arms against the Trollocs and the Murdral when they attacked the manor house. I think it was Lord Emmerin's manor house in Tyr.
Yep.
Wasn't Emmerin the one that went to the Black Tower?
Yeah. Which we saw him in this book.
Yeah. Very cool. I really liked him. So it sort of digressed from the Ogier. I've always wondered, I'd like to know more about the Book of Translation. I mean, I can certainly get an idea that it allows them to basically move to another reality, something like the Portal Stones or whatever, and take up another life somewhere else and basically abandon the world that they're in now. But that's a pretty hefty little trinket they've got there. How did they come by that? No one else knows anything about it.
Well, I mean, I've always kind of figured that it's a lot like the Horn of Valyr. It's a leftover relic that sits outside of a specific age. And, you know, who knows? It also seems to imply that, at the very least, the Steading-bound Ogier will have to go through if the book is opened. That, you know, it couldn't just be Loyal says, "Hey, anybody who wants to fight with me, come with me instead, and we'll go off and, you know, do what we do, and the rest of you can all go to your nice new world." It really does imply, particularly even in here, most already seem to have made up their minds to open the Book of Translation. They considered me an afterthought, and I knew that unless I spoke true, humanity would be left alone. So, I mean, I kind of wonder, it's like, well, are all Ogier tied to it? I mean, what happens if the last battle comes, they open the Book of Translation, and suddenly, oops, gardeners are gone too?
That would be an interesting scenario. And the thing that I wonder about is, we've had various glimpses of people that know a little bit about the mirror worlds and the worlds reached by portal stones and so forth and so on. But Verin said that the one constant was that there's one creator in all worlds and one dark one in all worlds. And if he's bound in one world, he's bound in them all. And if he's loosed in one, he's loosed in them all. So if that's the case, how would opening the Book of Translation to go to another one of these worlds necessarily, I mean, unless they went to one that was so strange and alien that there was no humanity there, how would that necessarily be a help for them?
I don't know. I also kind of wonder, I mean, the word Book of Translation, I mean, I wonder if it's not, if the book gets opened, that they're not actually going to another place, but that it is translating them into something else. kind of like, they become,
ascended.
Exactly. Like a different kind of matter or energy.
Well, I'm getting all these Stargate flashbacks because when I thought of the Book of Translation, I immediately thought of the quantum mirror. And then when you said that, I thought, oh my gosh, they're all going to just ascend, like the Rouskard or whoever, Hello.
The other thing in this particular little bit that we get that really sticks at me is our dead appeared standing in rings outside of the setting looking in. And I'm wondering, number one, are the ghosts still longing for the setting? And it seems like the setting seem to keep the spirits out.
Yeah.
You don't even get one of them wandering around inside.
It makes me think of the Murdral being slightly out of phase with reality, that maybe the Steading are slightly, out of phase with reality in some ways, although nobody's really brought that up, but they do feel the strange little chill as they go through, which sort of reminds me of when they go into the ways, and they feel like they're passing through ice water briefly. And actually, that's the same sort of sensation that Matt felt both times when he went through the Twisted Doorframe Triangle. The light and the chill seem to be pretty standard. I wonder what that means. It must mean something.
Do not know.
I'm surprised that the dead can't come inside the setting. That's kind of weird. Earlier in the books, Loyal said that there hadn't been any signs of Ogier dead walking. Maybe it was only humans, I think he reflected.
Mm-hmm.
But now we see that that's not true. I guess they're here. The pattern takes it all into account. They're all affected by it. So we should probably move on then to the actual prologue itself. And the first point of view that we come across is that of Alon Mondragoran.
Yes, so the prologue proper begins with Lon riding Mandarb across the Proska Flats in northern Saldea near the Blight. He is following the road he turned away from 20 years ago to follow Moraine. And he thinks that Nynaeve has learned to talk very well like an Aes Sedai and think like one. He's seen neither people nor Trollocs in days. He hears a noise and prepares for an arrow or some sort of attack. In response, a man walks around a hill leading a pack horse. He says he's pleased to find Lon and says he expected to find him on the Kremer Road. The man is Bulin, black hair and tanned skin, his retainer from so many years ago in the Eisdashar Palace. Then Eve told them he was coming. He brought badly needed supplies. At first, Lon refuses to let him follow, but Bulin tells him that his father was Mulkiri, and that he needs someone to give him permission to don the Hadori. And at last, Lon relents, and the two travel onward.
Well, that's a fairly straightforward scene. Obviously, we see basically Lon riding to his death in a lot of ways, or he thinks he is, and totally determined to do it all by himself. And not lead any other Mulkiri into death in the Blight as he sees it. So he's
not even Mulkiri at this point, too.
Anyone.
Anyone.
So he's sworn never to lead anyone into the Blight to die. And he's just going to go and chase those hordes of Trolloc and Murdral and the Shadow itself, probably at Tarwin's Gap, all by himself. Stubborn. Man, he's a match for Nynaeve in pure stubbornness, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. No, I love when, Lon rebuffs Bulin so many times. and finally, it's just, I have a Hadori. He's like, my father died before I grew old enough to be able to wear it. So I have no one to be able to. And it's just literally, it was such a kind of heart-wrenching thing. It's like, will you tell me I can't? It's like, and you just finally get that, that kind of, all right.
Yeah.
But if you're going to travel with me, you're going to travel quiet. We're not going to get a whole bunch of people following us, which of course is going to be set up for later in the book.
I know it's really pretty funny in a way. And Nynaeve set him up pretty well. And I just get the feeling, the more I read these chapters, that pretty much everyone in the Borderlands has got Lon's number. I mean, they all know he's stubborn, stupid sometimes, and they all just know how to get around him. Because they've all got it down to a science.
Well, it is that kind of first real glimpse at how much effort Nynaeve put into giving Lon every chance he possibly could have.
Yeah.
You know, in the track down Beulen, you know, that we met in New Spring. You know, it's like, how much did he have, or did she have to go through to research, like, everywhere he's been and, like, the locations of any Malkiri she'd be able to find and, you know, just anything like that. It just, you know, especially with how little time she's had lately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but, you know, she almost makes me think, I know that Robert Jordan has said that none of the major characters are Ta'veren, but she and Egwene both give that feeling to me sometimes that they just, if they're not Ta'veren, they're certainly overly endowed with luck, you know, and and Nynaeve basically has to do little more than walk into an inn to find a few Malkyrie, talk to them for 5 minutes, and then they're jumping up and down and shouting, the golden crane flies for Malkyrie, you know, for Termengeiden, you know, the golden crane flies for Termengeiden, and then they're off and running, you know, it's like, wow, you know, Ta'veren draw what they need to them, and I guess friends of Ta'veren do as well. This is the FOT, friend of Ta'veren.
Fought.
Some of that luck rubs off on him. But, you know, it's funny, too, because when you mentioned New Spring, that kind of jogged my memory a little bit. Remember in New Spring, one of the ways that they were running around looking for the young man that they thought might be the Dragon Reborn was to look for somebody who was in the Orden of Lucky.
Yeah, particularly the Black Aja.
Yeah, but apparently the incipient channelers, if you will, had a little more than their share of luck. So maybe that applies to women as well. Maybe female channelers are just, you know, gifted with a little more than their average share of luck.
It's very possible, I guess.
I mean, I know men and women are different, but they do have a lot of things in common as well. The only other thing that kind of bothers me about this chapter, you know, Beulen brings these supplies that are needed so badly, and it just seems foolhardy to me for somebody with Lon's skill and ability to go, you know, herring off across basically the entire known world. I mean, he's going from World's End and Zaldea to Tarwyn's Gap, couldn't get any farther apart and stay on the continent. And he hasn't got supplies? I mean...
Mm-hmm.
Hello.
Well, I mean, and he did. I mean, he makes the point, well, I can hunt and fish for anything I need. And Beulen looks at him and goes, really? Really?
Have you seen the land lately, Lord Lon? Yeah. Be lucky to find a rabbit. Yeah, anyway. But it just struck me as a little bit odd that he didn't prepare himself a little bit better. I mean, he had to know things were bad right along the edge of the Blight. And he's basically been dancing in and out of the Blight since he was a boy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's purposely going the way that nobody else is likely to be. It's like the most deserted, godforsaken part of the entire borderlands that he's traveling through so that he doesn't run into anybody that might possibly even think about wanting to follow him. I think a pack horse would have been in order.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So we leave Lon and travel back in time and quite further to the south and come upon Perrin, who is dreaming. He is hammering hot iron, and Hopper lies in a corner, which he feels is rather natural. He cannot seem to make anything useful out of the iron he's hammering, though, and is embarrassed at what Master Luan would think. Perrin realizes that he's trying to make something important, but he needs to understand the parts first. He still worries about what men will think about him and Bear Lane. He needs to spend time with Fael, and Hopper invites him to go run, but Perrin is afraid of losing himself to the wolf side. He hears hissing from the quenching barrel and pulls out a hot statue made of iron. It is a statue of Aurum, and he's screaming. It falls to the floor and breaks. Perrin now is in Maldon, only he's carrying the axe instead of the hammer. He kills the two Shaido, as he remembers. Aurum attacks him, but Perrin refuses to kill him. An image of Perrin splits off, turns into a wolf, and then kills Aurum. Suddenly, Perrin is back in the forge again. he pulls out more statues from the barrel. Tottle Carr, Jory Conger, Azael Thone, hundreds of tiny statues. The broken pieces of the Arum statue transform into hands that start reaching for him. Hopper then slams into him, and Perrin starts awake back in his camp. He is in his tent with Fael. They have been camped in a field for days since a bubble of evil caused red snakes to sprout from the ground, biting and poisoning hundreds. The Aes Sedai could not completely heal anyone who was bitten, and it takes a long time for him to go back to sleep.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that we're still dealing with the bubbles of evil, and I wish now that I could remember a tweet that Brandon just made about those, that they have apparently more significance than what we're thinking of, but I confess I don't have it, and I didn't look it up when I was told about it, so we'll have to maybe come back to that. You have to do a chapter on things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Bubbles of evil and other anomalies in the Wheel of Time.
The other thing that is of note, and before we go any further, by and large, we have taken almost completely unedited all of these various chapter summaries from Encyclopedia Watt, which is, you know, findable on any interweb at www.encyclopedia-watt.org.
Yeah, and we thank them very much. They've been very gracious about not complaining that we've used these without asking, really.
Yeah, Encyclopedia Watt, along with a lot of other various sites like the 13th Depository, are wonderful, wonderful resources. You know, if you need to know what someone was doing in a particular book, you can find out by going to Encyclopedia Watt, and they break down chapters by what characters are in them and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
It is a wonderful thing.
If you want to get involved in speculation about what's going on or what may be happening or what will happen, you can always go to Theoryland and find a lot of really incredible and detailed theories about what has and may happen in the Wheel of Time. And then, of course, we can't forget to mention our host site, dragonmount.com, which is also a great compendium of resources.
Mm-hmm. The one thing that hadn't been mentioned in this particular recap of Perrin's section is that the snakes particularly went after the channelers as well. And both of the Ashaman were bit and actually suffered pretty badly from the effects. I mean, it is several Perrin chapters later before both Grady and Nayald are sufficiently recovered to be able to do stuff again, including trying to make gateways. And actually, am I mistaken, or were the channelers who were bitten affected worse than everyone else too?
No, I don't think they were affected worse. In fact, I think they might have recovered a little more quickly, but their inability to function normally was more notable maybe than most of the other people in the camp. I think maybe one of the Aes Sedai might have been bitten, but I can't remember now.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not.
Unfortunately, I have just moved to a new apartment, so I do not have my books to hand in order to flip through and look it up really quickly.
I think the other notable thing that happens in this chapter is that Perrin is still waffling back and forth between carrying the axe and the hammer, at least in his mind. He's gotten rid of the axe in the real world, but he still has apparently some reservations about it and is incapable of forging, which is what he's always been so good at. He's just not, in his mind, able to really do what he needs to do, and he's got this ongoing image as he goes through the books of trying to make something but not being able to do it properly.
Yeah, and Encyclopedia Watt also notes that it seems significant that the Aes Sedai could not completely heal anybody who was bitten, which kind of harkens back to Avienda not being able to just quench the fires when the one guardsman, whose name was Adrin, in the Gathering Storm, caught fire as a result of a bubble of evil. It seems that bubbles of evil are channel resistant.
Yeah, they do seem to be that way. I didn't bring it up when we talked about the Gathering Storm, but the image just really came to me strongly when that fellow was consumed by the fire and set, you know, part of the manor house on fire as well, and then basically burned down to a black, glassy, sludgy, tarry blot that nobody could really remove. The fire that was resistant to being quenched and just seemed to, you know, go completely wild, it reminded me of the fiend fire in Harry Potter. know if you remember that, when they're in the Room of Requirement, and one of Draco's, it might have been Crab or Goyle, one of Crab or Goyle or anything, used Fiendfire, and it just went berserk, and it was very hard to, even Hermione had a hard time, you know, dealing with it. It just made me think of that.
That's true.
Sort of not only magic resistant, but channel resistant sort of thing. Anyway, the next point of view in the prologue is from one of our forsaken friends, Grendel, and she's hiding out in Natrum's Barrow with Arengar. Grendel, of course, prefers to observe matters from a distance, but Arengar wants to be in where the action is. The Great Lord was not pleased that she lost control of Egwene. Grendel uses the trickle of the true power that Morden and the Great Lord have given her as a reward, and basically teases Arengar with it. The true power strains and scars the pattern, we find out. What the Creator creates, the Great Lord can destroy, Grendel reflects. And then Delana enters and sits with Arengar. Yes, Delana enters and proceeds with her dalliance with Arengar. A personal alarm of Grendel's goes off, and Grendel goes out to meet her guard captain, Garamond. He reports that the guards have captured Picor Ramshalan, who was approaching Natrum's Barrow. She lays a lovely weave of compulsion on him, and under this weave, he says that the Dragon Reborn has sent him, but he wants to be king himself, and he will reward her greatly if she helps him. And he prattles on, and then she silences him. Grendel then commands Arengar and Delana to weave compulsion on Ramshalan to confuse Rand about the force of the weave. She wants to have both male weaving and a female weaving on him, in case that's what he's doing, reading the weaves, so that he will not suspect that it's Grendel there. She thinks that he probably has Nynaeve with him, and that Nynaeve might just have the skill to read compulsion. Grendel then weaves spirit from the true power to take over the mind of a dove. She sends Ramshalan back to Rand and has the dove follow him. Her mind is resting in the dove's mind, and she's basically seeing and hearing through the dove. She wonders if Luce Theron remembers her murder of Yannet. Through the dove's eyes, she sees Ramshalan reach Rand and Nynaeve and the Aiel that are with him. Through the dove's primitive ears, she hears something about boxes and Kalendor. She then sees the access key and begins to panic. She wraps Arengar and Delana in air, then opens a gateway with Sidar. She jumps through the gateway to a nearby hill and sees a flash of light as the gateway disappears. She feels a bale scream from the massive use of balefire. From the top of the hill, she sees that Matron's Barrow is just gone. Now that she's escaped and is over the shock, she now feels safe that Rand will assume that she was dead, but she worries that the Great Lord will be really angry with her that she caused the death of one of the Chosen. She will have to be careful now, though. Very careful.
Yes, this was our grand scene to vindicate Virginia, who said from the very moment that she read it that Grendel can't be dead. Something had to have happened, and she had to have gotten around it somehow. And yes, Virginia, you were definitely right.
I was also vindicated in my little pneumonia-influenced song from Dr. Horrible that Rand is going to wake up one day singing It's a Brand New Day, which she basically did without the musical interlude. And went off and just whacked Grendel pretty good. This time for real.
Yep.
No, he thought.
Yeah, unfortunately for Grendel, she's not as great a plotter as she thinks she is.
No.
I mean, the fact that she didn't realize what was going on from the moment somebody, appeared from the Dragon Reborn to meet with the person who lived, or the noble who lives in this place. I mean, come on, that screams trap a mile away. Even if he has problems killing women, I still wouldn't put it past him. It's like, it's like, wait a minute, is that an access key? Oh, shoot. I mean,
who knows?
No, I give her credit. She really thought quickly on her feet, going, oh, I'm going to snare you two so that the compulsion will be gone when the balefire kills you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was pretty quick. That was pretty quick thinking. And then her use of the dove, that was kind of bizarre. We've never seen other animals other than the typically seen shadow eyes, ravens and, what's the other thing? Ravens and rats. Ravens and rats. You know, I'm going to digress here. Why is it that the White Tower is warded against rats, but it has mice? we see when Egwene first goes to visit Baron Sedai and is given the dream to Angreal that Baron has an owl because he keeps down mice. They chew paper. And then another place later in the book, it's mentioned mice. Why the heck is the White Tower warded against rats and not mice?
Because mice are too small, fuzzy, and cute to be spies.
Yeah, but they're pests. Let me tell you, I have them. They're pests.
I'm just going to come down with too cute.
Hmm.
Darkwing can't use it because it's too cute.
Well, they're not that cute, trust me. They're really not cute when they've been crushed by a mousetrap. I hate that. I really hate that. But I refuse to have the things running around. I live way out in the country, so I'm sorry any animal rights people that I've offended, but yes, I do trap mice. Sorry, they're gone. I don't know balefire, so that's all I can do. Obviously, chasing them with a broom doesn't work, you know.
For some reason, I get the feeling that that mice are considered less carrion eaters, and it really seems like the Dark One's spies are primarily things that feed on death.
Well, yeah, I agree with you, because you're coming at it from the sense that the reason that the White Tower wards against rats is only because they are the possible spies for the Dark Ones. But I'm looking at that as a...
They're an inconvenience.
They're really darn inconvenient, ugly, dirty, and, they're pests of the highest order. I think if you're going to be warding against one, you might as well get rid of the other. I mean, the Blue Aja has their weave for calling and repelling insects, so that's really handy. I'd love to know that one.
It might come down to the parallel warding problem.
Mm.
In Eye of the World, Moraine says, "You know, well, if I could set wards that would keep everything out, but it wouldn't keep other things out, and it would be like a bonfire for any murderel that came in the area." And it seems like, the ward against mice and the ward against rats might be just too similar to both place at the same time. And they're like, well, since rats can be spies for the Dark One, let's go with the rat ward.
Well, rat ward. I like that. maybe I'm wrong, but I kind of got impression that was because the same person couldn't necessarily weave both types of wards. But I mean, there's loads and loads of Aes Sedai in the White Tower, and one of them could ward against rats, another one could ward against mice, another one could ward against insects. And as far as raising the bonfire for any murder all around, well, I think everybody in the world pretty much knows that there's a White Tower and it's where the Aes Sedai hang out, so that's not an issue.
True.
Like, hello. They've got everything but neon signs and spotlights in the sky to point to the White Tower as being the den of the Aes Sedai.
Mm-hmm.
No hiding there.
Yeah. No, I mean...
Sunshine didn't have any trouble finding it either.
But I mean, no, what you said, though, about Grandel using the dove, I really liked that segment just because it gave us insight into how the shadow communicates and how the ravens and rats are actually used.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yes, they have some consistent connection to the Dark One, but the Forsaken can actually utilize them and be the weird sight beyond sight kind of thing where suddenly you're seeing through the mind of particular beings. And I love that Grandel kind of curses herself for not having an owl around, because owls are apparently much easier to control and much, much easier to maintain your sense of self while you're with them instead of, stupid dove or pigeon.
Cooing dove in the morning. That made me think of, Gawain twitting men about, and she's harping at him, she's basically shrieking at him because Mindred doesn't know about Elaine and Egwene. Mindred doesn't want to know about them. He says, oh, men, such dulcet tones, like a cooing dove of the morning. Or maybe it was evening, cooing dove of the evening. I have doves and their cooing gets tiresome. They may be romantic briefly, but day in and day out, it's old.
I also had to appreciate Lady blah blah blah. He's going to, and she's like, compulsion. Why are you actually here? I'm supposed to come and talk to the person who lives here, but secretly I want to betray the Dragon Reborn because he's an idiot.
And, no, he's not very smart, you know.
And you could just see Grandel going, yeah, he's definitely not the idiot in this scenario, boy.
I know. That was pretty funny. The guy had a really, really high opinion of himself, though, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. I liked the way they read that in the audiobooks, too. They had him speaking in this flat monotone. It was great.
Yeah.
I like when go ahead.
No. I was going to say, and another one of the great points of this POV is we get a wonderful new word, Balescream.
I think I'll name my firstborn that.
You scream, or I scream, you scream, we all scream when Bale screams.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. I mean, I just, but you already mentioned it, but, you know, Grendel's in the dove's mind and she sees the access key and panics, like, oh no! The access key, the totem call. Ah! I can just imagine the shocked look on her pretty face.
Yeah.
And Angar standing there like a dummy. She's sitting there going, oh, that's a lot of power. I wonder what he's doing with that. You know?
Yeah.
Honestly, she did. Gee, I wonder.
There's a massive amount of channeling going on over there.
I wonder what he's doing.
And honestly, in a later chapter recap for this particular series, I'm going to use that exact phrase again. Gee, there's an awful lot of channeling going on over there. Because it doesn't just happen this one time in this book.
Pay no attention to that man behind the screen. He's just cooking his lunch, living alone. Oh, God. I couldn't believe he stood there. What a hell. Look at all that shit. And she can sense mail channeling, so she knows it's not an Aes Sedai. She knows it's got to be Rand or one of the Aishaman. Not good. What did you think they were doing? Making you a name day surprise or what? Oh, goodness. Yeah, that was pretty sad for almost last words.
Yeah, Arengar pretty much deserved to get deleted.
She certainly did. I mean, she couldn't have been so overawed by Delana's skills that she was, unable to concentrate, I wouldn't think, unless Delana has some skills that we've previously never before seen.
Yeah.
That whole scene was kind of creepy in the extreme, too. Yeah. And then they just stand there and let Grendel wrap them up in air, like, what were you guys thinking? I'm like, duh. I mean, both of them, well, of course, Delana couldn't feel the Sidene being channeled, but still, you know. Hey, I mean, I could just see what I was just expecting one of them to say, hey, Grendel, where are you going? Just out of the store, I'll be right back.
Don't mind me, I'm just going to twist my ankle.
Yeah, yeah. Go to the moon, be right back.
I have to go to the necessary.
Oh, my God. And then, and Grendel, you know, she's so full of her own little arrogance, you know, her I don't know even how to describe it, her delusions, her self-delusions. Now she feels safe that Rand's assuming she's dead. But she's a little worried that the Great Lord might be angry.
Yeah.
She's got a lot more to worry about than just Morden, doesn't she? Duh. I've never understood. Throughout this whole thing, I cannot understand why these otherwise relatively intelligent people that became the Forsaken would turn to the Dark One, you know, when the Dark One is writing prophecies like, you know, what we've seen, well, I guess I shouldn't say it because it's in the end of the book, but, you know, none of them sound very pleasant or comfortable. And I mean, like, would you believe, you know, the Lord of all liars that, yes, you're going to have power and glory and immortal life. Yeah, join me. Sure you will. Well, part of that was hard to figure out. I don't understand it. What do I know? All right, I guess we've mocked poor Grendel and Ram Shallan enough for now, and Arengar. Good thing these Forsaken are dropping like flies, or we'd probably be in trouble for mocking them.
Yes, so
I can't resist. No matter what Sylvie says about calling the Forsaken fools, it's generally not a very safe thing to do. But we here at the Fourth Age are fearless.
Yes. And we move on from the comedic stylings of Arengar to the drastic seriousness of Galad de Modred.
Oh, yes. So serious.
So the young Lord Captain Commander leads his 7,000 of the Children of the Light through a swamp on the border of Geladan and Altara. Gee, does that location sound familiar at all? There are swarms of bite-me's, which makes it a miserable trek, but Galad thinks that Asunamo will not expect this move. He leads his horse, Stout, and thinks about Valda and Morghais. The last battle will come soon. Dane Bornhald, Jarrett Beyer, and Trom are with him. Galad insists they will need the Aes Sedai to fight the Shadowspawn and the Forsaken, and his men reluctantly accept that. One of the scouts, Barlet, reports something ahead. There is a dead forest, the trees covered with gray lichen. There is also a slow river with bloated bodies of men and mules, which they have to ford. Galad plans to lead them to his estates in Andor. He hopes Delane now holds the Lion Throne. Barlet, who is a lean man with a scar on one cheek, returns and reports that the swamp ends ahead in a clearing. They ride ahead, but as they enter the clearing, 10,000 soldiers appear, white cloaks and Amadisians. It is a trap that has been set by Asunamo with the help of Barlet. Barlet coldly tells Galad that he is a traitor. Galad, Bornhald, and Beyer ride out to negotiate with Asunamo and the Lord's Captain with him. Gulliver, a lanky, bearded man who is hard but fair, and Harnesh, short, balding, and missing one ear from a dragon-sworn battle. They argue doctrine and philosophy. Galad's words seem to affect the Lord's Captain, but Asunawa will not budge. And finally, Galad offers to surrender himself if Asunawa will promise not to question any of his men. Asunawa reluctantly agrees to this, and the questioners then arrest Galad, strip him, and beat him into unconsciousness.
Nice guys.
Yeah.
I mean, they already got him. I don't know why they had to beat him. That was kind of superfluous, but questioners.
Yeah. Well, and the thing I really like about this, and pretty much every Galad chapter that we encounter, is just the way he moves people. I mean, I could almost begin to believe that he is also Taverin, even though we know he isn't. But he has this way. I mean, he makes his argument, and the arguments are more or less. There are times where he wavers, but by and large, they're generally very sound and very well thought out for the information he has. And, you know, he has an ability to sway people really, really well.
No, that is really good looking. Well, I think it has to do with, it's kind of a hereditary thing, I think. You know, I mean, even Elaine and Avienda, I think later on, both reflect on the fact that Rand has turned into one of these people that could dominate a room, whether he was wearing rags and had no title at all, just because they have that sort of presence. You know, Gareth Bryn's another one, and Galad, as we know, is a half-brother to Rand, and, you know, son of a king, basically. Mm-hmm. Royalty anyway, so I mean, I guess those bloodlines just come through. And now I think I have to bring this up. I know you're probably going to hit me, but the slow river with bloated bodies of men and mules, those mules have an additional significance. These are the mules that Robert Jordan promised us. And you say, what? Promised us? Well, as it happens, there is a story. You can probably find it on the web if you Google it. Actually, you can find it just by Googling Robert Jordan and dead mules, of all things. But before his death, Robert Jordan participated in a documentary on Southern writers. There is apparently a saying that no writer is a true Southern writer unless his or her books contain at least one dead mule. None of Jordan's previous books ever contained that important dead mule. So for these final books, Harriet and Brandon ensured the presence of at least one dead mule to finally ensure Robert Jordan's entrance into the pantheon of Southern writers. So we not only have one dead mule, we have a plethora of dead mules.
With the possibility of more dead mules to come.
Maybe more. There could be many, yeah. Mules dropping, mules to the right of me, mules to the left of me, dropping like flies.
And Encyclopedia Watt is also quick to point out here that the bodies and the mules have floated south from Malden.
Oh, our favorite city. Yes, that's because that's actually also another little indicator of how badly out of sync the timelines are in this book. It's not accidental. It's just the way it had to be in order to do the story arcs so that they made sense. Split up into three books. Farron's story arc had to fall behind and gather in Storm, and now maybe most of this book he's playing catch up. So if you pay close attention, you'll see various different clues as to where Farron's points of view and Farron's chapters are in time compared to the rest of them. But most of the Farron chapters in Towers of Midnight are, what was the proper word for that? Contemporaneous? I don't know. Basically taking place during the same time frame as the last part of Gathering Storm.
And to that same extent, so was Gallet, because they are also in a previous sort of time sink.
Yeah, they're actually in the same place and time, dancing around each other. Well, then we'll get to that. I think it's interesting that Dane Bornhold and Jarrett Bayar, who were the elder Bornhold's right-hand men, if you will, have basically attached themselves to Galad now, and they're running after him all the time, doing his bidding here and there. They're not really his captains, but they're lieutenants anyway. They're kind of his right-hand men. It's just another example of how some relatively minor characters stay around for the longest time during all this long series of books. And Dane Bornhold, actually the elder Bornhold, and his son make their appearance really early on, and so does B.R.
And I've never liked B.R.
Who could?
I really haven't.
Even his mother couldn't like B.R.
Well, it's always weird because he's, like, feverishly hateful of Dark Friends, and particularly Perrin, but he's also always described as speaking kind of monotone and being a kind of non-existent person. Like, I mean, they describe him like, you know, every ounce of flesh has been boiled off of his face and his eyes are sunken so that it looks like he's a skull. And
yeah.
I mean, and just, he's like, yes, you could cut your bonds on that rock and escape because you're slowing us down.
Yeah, your guards also sleep tonight. No, B.R. is pretty evil. He's actually everything you don't want a white cloak to be. And he's like the really dark face of the white cloaks that unfortunately has come to represent all too many of them. I mean, basically, I think their theme's a lot of these psycho killers. And not lobster killers either, psycho killers. White cooks are nuts among them. I don't even understand how Galad, with his desire to write all the time, could even get involved with them. I guess he's really into rehabbing them. I don't know.
Well, I mean, and he's following the teachings of the original founder.
Yeah, Lothair Montalar, whatever his name was. I know. And then, actually, if you read the few excerpts that we've been given from The Way of the Light, they probably were never intended to be the Aes Sedai hating, you know, witch burning, you know, knock people's doors down and then confiscate their books, et cetera, that they turned into.
Mm-hmm.
But I unfortunately have Egyanen's point of view toward them. They're a military body answerable to no one other than themselves. That's an abomination. So, yeah, I have never had any use for the white cooks. Sorry. Probably the only time I really am in complete agreement with the Shantian philosophy. Philosophy. I can't even talk tonight. I'm sorry.
The only thing was is that the dead forest with the trees, if I remember properly, it wasn't just that they were gray with lichen. I mean, it seemed to me not necessarily. I was expecting something bad to happen as they were riding through those trees. I was thinking, this is, you know, another corruption. It's a, you know, like a piece of the blight manifesting in the, you know, in the south, or, you know, and I was kind of let down a little bit when the trees just turned out to be dead trees.
But they had lichen.
Yeah. I expected the lichen to be poisonous or something, or...
Yeah, you were thinking of blight trees. You wanted them to start reaching out and grabbing white cloaks and flinging them around.
Well, just I figured something would happen. It was just like, oh, look, this place has just become a stagnant dead swamp.
Yeah.
Okay, that's inconvenient, but whoop-de-doo, there are bigger problems in the world.
Well, there was also some implication that the swamp was actually larger or continued on farther than the maps indicated, and that makes me wonder if there wasn't another geographical translocation going on, like what's happening in the White Tower and the Palace of Andor. I mean, surely not just rooms. You're going to switch around. It's a lot easier to switch around parts of a swamp, to be honest with you. Who could tell one part of a swamp from another?
You know? Yeah, true.
Maybe it's a little boring for the shadow to try and switch around. Speaking of, do you think that's intentional, or is it just a side effect?
I don't know.
Shadow actually sitting there, let's see, I think I'll take this room in the Palace of Andor and put it over here. And what really freaks me out about that is that the parts of the buildings are put together, but they're seamless. I mean, you don't see like a jagged chunk in the floor where it didn't quite fit together right. It's like...
Yeah, I mean, it's a one-to-one transaction.
Yeah, it changes. And, you know, and they don't have to be the same size or, you know, anything else. It's just like, okay, this hallway is now over here. What? You know, doesn't that leave stairways going nowhere or holes in the floor?
Well, in
or?
Some cases it does, because I remember, wasn't it one of, like, Alana's rooms or something in the Stone of Tear where it moved and suddenly her door just opened into dead
a
space?
Wall. Yeah. It was a wall, I think. It just opened into a wall. I don't remember. I don't think it was Alana. I think it was Egwene or Nynaeve, maybe.
I don't remember now.
I can't remember either. Okay, you got us. Whoever knows can tell us. Yeah, that was pretty weird. And then off an hour, this guy just won't go away either. This is another white cloak that is like, this is the guy you really want representing your bunch of guys? This guy's like evil incarnate. You know, he's almost like Bayar's mean uncle. You know?
Well, I mean, he's the Takamata of Rand World.
Yeah, pretty much.
Takamata? You can't Takamata of anything.
Yeah! Takamata. Nice historical alliteration there, too. I like that. Or is that allusion? I don't remember now. I'm really losing it tonight.
Well, it's an allusion to Mel Brooks, but at the same time. Thank you, History of the World Part 1.
I'd forgotten about that one. Oh, God.
Hey, Takamata, what do you say?
Yeah, okay. I like when Galad rides out to negotiate with Asanawa, and they argue about doctrine and philosophy. Okay. That Galad is...
Well, I mean, it was like, you know, didn't you see, weren't you there and witness, you know, that I bested him in fair combat beneath the light?
No, you're
everything.
A dark friend. No, you're a dark one. No, you use dark powers. That's it. Never argue with a fanatic. It's just not worth it. Thankfully, leaving the questioners in white cloaks to their own devices for a while, we're going to move on to the next point of view, which is our dear, long-lost friend, Padan Thain, who is no longer merely Padan Thain. And as we see Thain walking through the blight, he's carrying his ruby dagger. The sky above him is black. The only emotion he has left is hatred for Rand and the Dark One. He bizarrely keeps cutting himself with the blade of the ruby-tipped dagger, but he doesn't care. He was once Thain, once Mordeth, but now he needs a new name. He's just finished killing a worm. They make a lot of noise, so he hopes that any Trollocs nearby will send scouts to investigate. Sure enough, a group of Trollocs led by a Murdral appear. A mist then comes out of the ground, and it kills the Fade and turns the Trollocs into zombies of some sort. Thain no longer hunts Rand. He plans to meet him at Shael Ghul and kill him. Okay, don't get me started on zombie Trollocs! I don't want to go there again!
There is an interesting... There's an interesting thing here, and it's the note that Encyclopedia Watt gives us, which is that the mist in which Fane uses to kill all of the Trollocs and then revive them seems to be very, very reminiscent of Mashadar from Shadar Logoth. And it makes a great deal of sense, considering that Mordath is part of Fane. But now I'm wondering, now that I'm thinking back on it, and it does unfortunately go into zombie Trollocs a little bit. Back in Shadar Logoth, you never really saw any indications of, you know, Trollocs anywhere, like even Trolloc skeletons or anything. And I'm not wondering if maybe there is more to what happens to a, you know, a creature that is killed by Mashadar than just, oh, it eats the soul and then the body's like, eh. So I'm kind of wondering what happens if Mashadar did kill something. You know, there very well could be, you know, odd, like, half-alive, rotting, you know, plague-infested corpses about Shadow of Goth, and we just never saw them.
I don't know. Well, I don't know. You would think if all the Trollocs that had ever been killed in Shadow Logoth turned into zombie Trollocs, that Rand and company and Moraine and everybody who went through there the first time would have seen some zombie Trollocs, but no. They only ever saw the couple of fists of Trollocs that came in after them looking for them.
Well,
and
I mean,
no indication of any other sorts of Trollocs. So I'm going to say no. I think this is Fane's little twist on what Mashadar did, because he's more than Mordath now. He's Fane, who was touched directly by the Dark One and combined with Mordath. And this is another of this weird example. I've brought this up before of, you know, these recombinant characters. You know, we've got Luke and Isom. Isom become Slayer. You know, the man with two souls, Mordath and Fane somehow merge together to become something else. It's kind of creepy and weird when you think about it.
Yeah. Well, and honestly, Padden Fane is creepy and weird. I mean, I was very unnerved by this particular little snippet with him, because, I mean, here he is, he's wandering through the Blight, you know, he's holding the dagger with his fingers wrapped over top of the quillions, which are supposed to protect you if, you know, a blade is incoming, so that the blade will cut his fingers.
Yes. And so he thinks that perhaps he should get some gloves, but then he wouldn't be able to cut himself, so he abandons that idea.
And so he's got the blood that's dripping on the ground, and I'm just imagining it's kind of smoking, too. I mean, it seems he's thinking about, oh, just killed a worm, and they're pretty loud when they die. And
they kill them the right way, you know.
Yeah, exactly. You have to take time to kill them properly.
Yeah, it's really messy to do it the right way, but, you know, got to be done. Somebody's got to do it.
Just, I mean, it is, and it's kind of like this. Oh my lord, he's become, you know, this monster. You know, it's like there's almost nothing reminiscently human in him anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a scuzz in Eye of the World, but I mean
yeah, he was just a jerk. He wasn't necessarily like the ultimate, you know, big bad.
Not a whole lot, though, more that we can really say about the Padden Fane segment of the prologue.
Oh, ew. Red and black, black and red, so beautiful.
And honestly, that sounds a little bit like the voices in the Ways.
Oh, Machin Shin, yeah.
Yeah. Yes, I think
was.
Sums up the Padden Fane segment of the chapter very well.
Yeah. We still haven't seen these worms. You know, I remember, was it Asmodian Fane? Did you know there are like, what do they call them, embryonic worms? They're embryonic, what is it, Jufara? What was the name?
Oh, I don't remember.
Jumara, I think. Jumara, they're like, you know, like an earlier stage, like a larval stage or something of, I think it was Jumara in the Blight. Of course, they'll never transform now, he says. But, you know, imagine opening a stasis box and finding a bunch of those. You know, okay. That was at one of those forsaken tea parties or something.
Yes, Jumara.
Or maybe it was Samael. Samael. Maybe Samael was talking to Grendel.
Aganor made Jumara, and Samael notes that they are loose in the blight and are now called worms. That they will never undergo their metamorphosis.
Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Now, I wonder why they will never undergo their metamorphosis now.
I don't know. Yeah, what did they need to do that? I mean, something's not there anymore. Is this like the missing amino acid in Jurassic Park that's supposed to protect us?
Lysine contingency for Jumara.
Yeah. Padden Fain has been creepy from almost day one. And then I don't even want to go into that segment where he's talking about meeting old friends and how you treat them. Ugh. Oh, God. I mean, that, okay, right there. The creepiness to the max. Okay, so I think it's time to leave Padden Fain. Do you have anything else to add to that chapter, Andrew?
No, I think sums it up very nicely.
Yeah, thank you. You do that really well, by the way. Sort of the Homer Simpson little cringe. Okay. I believe that may be our first Simpsons crossover. Our next point of view, and our last point of view in the prologue, is that of the commander of Heath Tower, Malinaran Rai. And Heath Tower is the northernmost watchtower near the Blight in Kandor. And Malinaran reviews reports, including a letter from a merchant named Baraga, who wants to bring his caravan to Heath Tower to trade. He's also making plans to give his father's sword to his son Keemlin, who will reach his name day in 3 days. He meets Jargon, the sergeant of the watch, and Jargon reports that a signal flash from Rena Tower to the northwest and the blight itself has been seen. Niachokotomo is the commander there. They wait, but there is no further message from Rena Tower. There is also no response from Farme Tower. Malinaran then orders a warning message to be sent to the southward towers, and he also orders messengers to be sent south. Fast riders, usually young boys. He is relieved that Keemlin is next on the messenger roster, and so he may ride to safety. He goes to the roof, where Lieutenant Londolin reports no response from Barkland Tower to the south either. Malinaran sees three riders heading south as well. He orders the tower to prepare for assault. He is then shocked to see Keemlin come up to him, as he was supposed to be riding out. Keemlin admits that he sent Teon in his place. Teon's mother, Lady Abbas, has lost all of her other sons, and Keemlin thought that it would be best if Teon rode off in his place. Malinaran is nearly overcome. He orders a soldier named Kral to bring his father's sword to him. Keemlin protests that it is still 3 days away from his name day, but Malinaran says that a man stands before him now. Malinaran gives him the Borderlander oath and then gives him the sword. Someone shouts, and they all see Drakkar in the air and a horde of Trollocs approaching. Dun 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 dun.
I do have to say that, you know, since I read these, you know, books out loud with my wife, when you get to one of those really charged emotional, you know, portions of the text, and that it is really hard not to get choked up. And this particular, the entire ceremony with the sword atop the tower and facing down it was possibly one of the harder things I've had to read in the last few months out loud. So it was just one of those kind of, you know, a lot of, you know, choking and oh, my voice is tired. Kind of lame excuses to try to preserve, you know, the minor amount of manliness that I could claim at that point. And
I know,
but I mean, it was a very beautiful scene, but it's also one of those really, really emotionally charged things. And when you're reading that section, you're like, oh, he's mentioned that his son is going to become a man in 3 days and there's going to be a sword, and that's not going to happen. There's no happy end here at all.
No, none at all. I know, it is a very touching and emotional scene, and unfortunately doing the summary doesn't really do it justice at all. We just sort of blow past it, but that's the nature of a summary. But yeah, it is a great scene. One of probably the best, I think, in the book. And it makes you want to know really more about the Borderlanders and their culture. You know, ever since New Spring, we've seen that there's just more to them than really meets the eye. And, you know, we got a little taste of it when the Shinarans were all traipsing around after Nynaeve and Elaine. But, they're really honorable and good people, and they have a lot of really wonderful customs that are just sort of touched on in the book. And I actually wouldn't mind seeing Not that we're going to get any of the outriggers or prequels or anything else, but I really wouldn't mind seeing a book about the Borderlanders in a lot of ways. You know, a lot of history there, a lot of tales to be told, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'd like to see something about Malkier, too, before it died, overcome by the Blight. We saw a little glimpse of it in Nynaeve's test for Accepted, you know, where the Seven Towers had not been broken. And this is just like, I mean, it's just so painful, really, to watch all the happenings in this part of the chapter, because, I mean, the characters are carrying on bravely, but they have to know that this is really, really bad news, that all these towers are sending out signals and then not being heard from again. And it's the beginning of the end. I mean, it's the opening scenes of the last battle, and these guys have to know it. They're all soldiers, and yet they just continue to do their duty and still find the time and place to do noble things for their fellows, like Keemlyn allowing a noble woman's last son to go off to safety, and hopefully safety in his place, while he stays there basically with his father, probably to die.
And, you know, honestly, you kind of hope that, you know, maybe, even if they are going to die, that maybe you'll get at least another scene with them later.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we didn't see the Renald Fanwar again. You know, we kind of expected him to appear, you know, along with the Borderlanders with Lon, and so far, Renald is nowhere to be seen. So it's like, you know, are we going to get, you know, a small chapter at what the little guys are doing in Towers of Midnight, or not Towers of Midnight, A Memory of Light or not?
I don't know. There's so many plot lines to wrap up. I don't know how many minor characters he's going to be able to give space to. But
you know, even if you get, like, a paragraph.
Yeah, yeah. I have to say, I can't see the name Renald Fanwar without thinking of Renald Blazglib. Renald Blazglib. That's what my mates call me. It's a nickname. Sorry. Really obscure Harry Potter crossover there. Anyway, so we've gone from Pedden Fane and dead mules to from one end of the Borderlands to the other in the prologue here, with a few worms and Forsaken thrown in for good measure. Not to mention foppish Domani. Was he Domani? Ramshalon? Yeah, he was Domani.
Yes, he was Domani.
Yep. Foppish for sure.
Yes, definitely.
Who would you cast as Ramshalon?
I don't know.
I have somebody in mind, but I can't think of the guy's name, like one of the British character actors, you know, the Monty Python-ish type. Well, I'm here to negotiate for the Dragon Reborn, because he's really an idiot, and I think I'm a lot smarter than he is. Can't stand it, I'm sorry. There was a lot going on in this prologue, now that I'm reading back over this. A lot of foreshadowing for things in the future, which we will not reveal to you at this time. I like this section, you know, where in Perrin's point of view, we didn't mention it, but when he's in the normal dream, wolf dream sort of thing, and just before he actually dreams that he's in Maldon, or just as he's dreaming that he's in Maldon, Perrin sees an image of himself. It's kind of surprised, you know, is he really that, you know, impressive of a person, you know?
Yeah.
Like, wow, that's me?
Well, and on top of that, I mean, it is kind of also a confrontation with his berserker side, because Perrin is the berserker in this series.
Yeah.
You know, he goes into a battle rage and the wolf comes out and things die.
Yeah, messily.
Sometimes in slicey dicey ways, and a lot more of the time in clubby smashy ways.
Yeah, you know, it always kind of astonished me that, you know, he hated what the axe did so badly. You know, he hated, you know, cutting into a guy or slicing his throat or whatever, and yet he has no problems at all taking that hammer and bashing it in a guy's face. Okay. Well, not no problems, but you would think that that would be way more of a gross out, you know, than a simple slice and dice or chopping a dozen white cloaks into mincemeat. That's what you said. Apparently you do this all the time. Who are you, farm boy, the Dragon Reborn? Another thing I thought was kind of interesting that we find Egwene doing later is, and I don't think it's much of a spoiler, it's Grendel's little personal alarm. She sets a weave someplace, and if somebody crosses it, apparently, or something happens, it makes some little sound audible only to her. I think it was maybe waves crashing against each other or something. And no one else can hear it or anything like that. Like, that's really kind of tricksy and cool, you know? We never hear of... Yeah, we never find out who Yannet was either, did we?
I don't think so. I mean, I imagine it would possibly be in there somewhere, but I could not tell you where.
It's not on encyclopediawatt.org, for sure. So do you have any last thoughts on the prologue, War Towers of the Night?
No, I think I am fairly well happy with Prologos.
Well, I'm amazed that we got all the way through it all by ourselves. I think we did pretty well. Hopefully,
yes, I do.
The listeners will think so as well. So, that'll wrap us up for this episode. We are grateful, as always, to have you listeners with us for another fun time. I hope you enjoy listening to us talk about the Wheel of Time as much as we do talking about it and recording.
If you'd like to get a hold of us, you can always either call us at 1-888-333-7690 and leave us a voicemail. You can email us at podcast@dragonmount.com. And of course, you can find the forums and the comment sections for each of the podcasts at our host site at dragonmount.com.
You can also find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, all those good things. And so, I think that'll wrap us up. Thanks, Andrew, for being here tonight. I'm glad you were able to make it, since everybody else got unavoidably detained. Hopefully not by anything dire. And so this is Virginia, saying may the light illumine you until we meet again.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravyan Indo Manchima, Taishite.
Fourth Age Podcast is brought to you by DragonMount.com. To contact us, visit our website, DragonMount.com/podcast.
Another one, but
it's not letting me stop.